In the summer of 2008, 130 top NASA scientists and engineers and one decidedly unscientific observer spent 3 months exploring the North Pole of Mars via the Phoenix Mars Lander, robotic backhoe which collected soil samples and color images from the surface of the red planet. The observer was Andrew Kessler, who was given full access to Mission Control to document with fresh eyes this latest chapter of planetary exploration. Mr. Kessler's often very funny account of what happened, Martian summer, robot arms, cowboy spaceman, and my 90 days with the Phoenix Mars mission is published by Pegasus. He is a creative director at Huge, and his writing has appeared in the New York Times and on the Discovery Channel. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, Huge is an ad agency?
That's correct. We're located in Dumbo, in Brooklyn.
And you're a creative director there. How does a creative director of an ad agency wind up tagging along with NASA scientists working on the first man-made probe of Mars?
I suspect that the mission was looking for someone who might have a different perspective on space.
Yeah, but they didn't call me. I would have had a different perspective.
Correct. Maybe, I don't know, do you have a listed number?
Probably. I don't want to talk about that.
So
they know how to reach me.
I guess that they contacted me because they were looking for someone with a bit of a science background, which I had, a little bit of a journalism background, which I had, and made some quirky, funny things. And I thought they might want to promote the mission to get the word out to new audiences. And so that's sort of my job.
And you'd also met Peter Smith.
The first time I met Peter Smith was in Tucson after they started this search to look for someone to help them with their cause of promoting this mission, and I went out there to hang out with him and meet him, and I sort of fell in love with his Mission Control building and his story, and then I was hooked.
And did you take on this assignment with the idea that you might write a book?
Yes. Initially, no. I was actually going to help Peter just pitch ideas, ways to promote the mission in general. And then he was interested in doing some kind of book project. And I just thought, wow, this would be an amazing opportunity.
So to some degree, NASA right now is feeling like an orphan within government. This was also an opportunity in their eyes to get the word out about some of the interesting things they do.
Yes, I hope they feel that way. I'm not exactly certain how they feel.
Well, once they read the book.
They read the book, they'll hopefully feel that it was an amazing opportunity to get the word out and attract new audiences to space.
So what was the role you finally wound up filling in the 90 days you spent there?
So probably in the first few weeks, my role was irritating guy who asks lots of questions. But over time, I started to pick up on what was happening, and I learned how all the instruments worked. And then I was this kind of information disseminator and gatherer, and then I was a friend to people on the mission, and that was kind of a remarkable thing.
Irritating guy because it was apparent that you didn't know as much about science and you were going to have to learn on the job?
Painfully apparent. I thought that I had done such a great job. I did all my due diligence in the year running up to the mission, studying, and then I got there and I knew nothing. These guys have dedicated their lives to these very specific tasks in running this mission and doing this pretty specialized Mars science. And having the hubris to think that I could learn that in a year was a big mistake, but they were very patient with me.
Everybody? Weren't there people opposed to your presence?
So, yes, I was a bit of a controversial figure. I think, one, some people are opposed to promoting a mission in general. They don't think that's a very palatable idea. They think that these missions should sell themselves. And I guess there were some people opposed to just having someone there that might kind of display the messiness of what happens in everyday mission control life.
And I'm sure there were also some huge egos there because not everyone can be a rocket scientist.
Well, no, but you have 130 rocket scientists who all do this amazing work. And somehow, even with their giant egos and dedication to one specific kind of experiment set, they somehow come together to make it all work every day.
But there's also a political aspect to any office, and we're talking about a highly politicized situation.
Right. So most offices aren't operating a $500 million lander 200 million miles away. So there's an edge to it.
There had also been a failed mission in the late 90s. Did that weigh heavily on everybody's mind?
So most of the people that worked on this mission also worked on that failed mission.
Which was a big screw-up, wasn't it?
Well, screw-up. That's pretty harsh, no, Leonard? I think that these things, they're not really screw-ups. It takes so much. I mean, that's the really amazing thing that I learned is it takes so much to get to Mars. It's crazy what they endure to get there and the amount of work that it takes. That screw-up is really relative. They're working on very difficult conditions, and it's really hard to set an 800-pound hunk of metal safely down 200 million miles away after a 10-month journey through space.
So this time they plan to do it differently than they had the previous time.
So this time they were
using all just the metric system, or were they also doing inches?
So what you're referring to a different mission that failed. But this one, they had a difficult task of engineering some of the problems out of a lander. They used a recycled lander body that they knew was flawed. It didn't make it down to the surface. Well, it made it down, but it made it down in about 500 pieces, which is no good. You want it down in one piece. So they had to engineer all the flaws out of this lander that had been built for very little money the first time around. And so they worked really hard to basically... One major problem was the radar, and they didn't know if it was locking on the ground, and there were lots of huge technical hurdles to overcome, and somehow they made it work.
My guest is Andrew Kessler, who's written a book called Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spaceman, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission. It is published by Pegasus, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You describe the office as being like a rec room or a church basement, but much more.
I guess there's a little bit of a
I would have thought it'd be much more high tech than
that. Yeah, there's kind of a letdown when you get there, and it feels like the rec room at your local religious institution rather than this kind of glowing orb titanium surface place that looks like the Star Trek or something. It doesn't look like that. But nevertheless, even though they have little cubes and it looks like kind of any office with industrial carpet, what they do there is still quite amazing. And that's part of the fun, right? You have this mundane workaday office environment, but you're doing this sublime task every day.
But you're on different time, aren't you? This is not a 9-to-5 job. Is it 9-to-5 Martian time?
Yeah, so I don't know how you say 9-to-5 Martian. I guess it's 9:40 to 5:40. So the Mars day is about 40 minutes longer than an Earth day. So if you want to work on a mission like this, you have to track with Mars time. And so we were these humans living on Mars time on Earth. So every day we would advance our clock about 40 minutes to keep up with the lander so that we could operate it successfully. And so that means that every day, if you go to work today at 9 o'clock, tomorrow you're in at 9:40 and then 10:30. And soon it's like this terrible jet lag starts to descend upon you. And jet lag isn't just an annoyance because when we face it here on Earth, we get used to it. You go to L.A. and you catch up eventually. But when you're working on Mars time, this clock keeps moving, and so you never settle into it.
Well, so after a couple of days, you're now starting 2 hours later. After a week, you're turning night into day, aren't
right.
you?
And then eventually, after 36 days, you lose an entire day. And then you're all mixed up and you feel terrible. And
what happens to circadian rhythms?
So I don't know. There are no more. There's no more rhythm. It's a discord of I don't know what it is. But what happens is, I guess, that your endocrine system starts to slow, as it was described to me. And you have trouble moving kind of hormones around your body and getting excited about things. And so soon everyone's really kind of cranky and moody, and that adds to the drama a little
bit. And fatigued, I'd imagine, as
well.
Very
fatigued. It's really hard on you.
Were you able to just go home and go to sleep and keep sleeping later and later in the morning?
I did a terrible job. In spite of having my trusty Mars watch, which was built by this kind of remarkable watchmaker in Pasadena, I had a very difficult time keeping up with my Mars lag. And I would wake up at completely random times, wide awake in the middle of the night, the middle of the day. And then you're never quite sure because your clock reads nighttime, but it's bright outside. And then you're just all over the place.
What do you do to deal with the fatigue?
Wow. Well, I tried taking these these pills that they recommend for night shift workers. And but those made me feel even crazier. So that didn't work much. So I guess you just grin and bear it because you're working on Mars.
Well, I don't know what the environment is like, but many years ago, I worked a night shift. I did radio show after midnight. But even before that, I worked in a type shop from midnight to 8. And I was coming home just as the rest of the world was waking up. And nobody thought twice about making a lot of noise. There were people fixing the street. There were cars honking their horns. It was almost impossible for me to try to live a normal life.
Yes, it was very difficult. I think the reverse was true also. We lived in some corporate housing nearby, and occasionally we would hold barbecues at 7:30 in the morning after shift, much to the surprise of some of the other neighbors in the complex.
What else did you discover during your time at Mission Control about the scientists and the engineers? Were there things that surprised you? I mean, other than that as smart as they were just regular guys like you and me? And I assume women as well.
And women as well. I guess the thing that surprised me most is how dedicated they were to this impossible task. People don't leave when the day is done. They kept going through the weekends, through their vacations. A lot of these scientists had to budget out their mission 5 years ago, and they had long overdrawn against their resources for spending their time, and they were there on their vacations. They were there, you know, families suffered and people risked their health in order to make this thing work. And so that's a level of dedication that you don't see very often.
And I'd imagine that it's one thing to be single and doing this, another thing to be in a family and living on a totally different clock than everybody else.
I think it was
your kids are going to school.
Yeah, I think it was really hard on people with families to live these lives in Mission Control.
So then you have other issues, like things go wrong. And when people are irritable and things go wrong, that can just make things worse, can't it?
It can make things. And it does. I mean, at some point, I mean, it's easy to write that, oh, they made a mistake or something didn't work. But what's missing from those stories is all the fatigue, all the pressure that everybody's under. And yeah, I mean, you feel bad for them when they miss something easy that seems easy, digging up a scoop of dirt or something. Everybody knows how to do that. But the complexity on Mars is, I don't know, it's really the point of the book is to get at describing that complexity and how these guys work through it.
Were they also feeling the pressure of all the threats to NASA, the talk about shutting NASA down?
I don't know how much they feel that. I think inherently they know that some of their funding is going away, and that's why maybe they were willing to take a risk and let a kind of ordinary guy like myself in to poke around and talk to people. But I think they're just really keen on doing their jobs well.
What's the Phoenix Mars Lander look like? What does it look like, and what is its actual job?
So its main job was to go to Mars with a long digging arm and scoop up ice from the North Pole of Mars.
Well, first you have to land it on Mars. So you send a rocket with this thing attached.
Right. So if we back up a little bit, you launch on this Delta V rocket, takes off, flies at 65,000 miles an hour, hurtling through space, getting radiated. Ah, it's flying fast. And then it goes, slows down a little bit. And then it has to do this crazy dramatic thing where it has to enter the Mars atmosphere, get all heated up. It has all this sensitive scientific equipment that's rattling around. And then it has to gently put that down on the surface of Mars. So it has these rockets that first it has a parachute that deploys and it starts to slow down. And then
a parachute can work? There's enough atmosphere on Mars for a parachute to be effective?
Yes, I would be silly to disagree with you because it worked. So it landed, and then these rockets start to fire once it's slow enough. The parachute falls away, and then it gently sets itself down on the surface.
And how long did all of this take from Earth to Mars?
10 months. It took 10 months to get there, and then about 7 minutes for that last nervous bit of it falling through the atmosphere.
Do people pay attention during the 7 months or only during the 7 minutes?
No, I think there are a lot of people paying attention. They do a lot of work during those 10 months where they are basically figuring out the operations that they'll do on the surface, because most of the effort up until then had been going into making sure that it landed safely. So then they're doing the kind of the human part of figuring out how they're all going to work together.
And there's this lag, because any signals you send to the lander takes how long to get there?
A signal takes 15 minutes to get to Mars, and then
so you do something, you don't know if it's actually working for 15 minutes plus 15 minutes back.
So it would be a total of 30-minute round trip, which is why you actually can't work like that. So it's not possible. I mean, if you imagine trying to play that claw game, you know, where you're scooping up mm-hmm. little lobster harmonicas or something on a 30-minute lag, it would never work, right? So the operations that they've come up with, the Jet Propulsion Lab, who are like these masters of organizational schemes, they cooked up this way of planning out the lander's day in advance, and then they upload all the information. The lander wakes up in the morning. There's a set of instructions. It does its best to execute those instructions, and then it goes to sleep at night, and it sends back its results. And then the team scrambles to understand those results and plan for the next day.
So it's not just scooping up things. It's also doing analysis of what it's scooped up.
Right. So its main job is to scoop up and then put into the Phoenix instruments. Phoenix came with a bunch of interesting scientific gear that basically was designed to analyze what was there. I mean, this was our first time digging into this kind of Martian permafrost at the North Pole. And then what we saw was pretty amazing.
We'll come back to that in just a moment. My guest is Andrew Kessler, who is a writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times and the Discovery Channel. He is also a creative director at the huge ad agency in Brooklyn. And he's written a book called Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spaceman, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission. It is published by Pegasus. Stay with us. We're back with Andrew Kessler. His book, Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spaceman, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission, published by Pegasus. So it's scooping up all of this stuff. What was the greatest discovery of the mission?
Probably. I mean, they discovered a lot of things. So ice, liquid water, and clouds, snow clouds, all kinds of cool stuff. But probably the one blockbuster that they found was this stuff called perchlorate in the soil, which I think is a fascinating story about scientists initially finding some weird result, fighting about it in a very intense and passionate manner, the media picking up on it, a conspiracy theory being born, and then all of a sudden it resolves to this wonderful truth about this mystery chemical called perchlorate.
Is there such a thing as perchlorate on Earth?
Yeah, on Earth, it's actually a groundwater contaminant, which is really confusing when you go to write a nice story about perchlorate on Mars, because people think, oh no, we've already contaminated Mars and we just got there. But the perchlorate on Mars, and it also comes in Earth, is on Earth in a kind of an interesting place, and it maps really nicely to our Mars story, because the perchlorate on Mars has probably been hiding something that we've been looking for there for a long time, and that's organic material. When Viking first went there in the 70s, they were hopeful to find at least a little bit of organic material. It's this fingerprint of life, you know.
Because with water, there's the possibility of life.
With water and organic material, you have a good recipe, you know, all the ingredients are there. But we didn't. We didn't find anything, not even trace amounts that you would have expected, like just kind of ended up there haphazardly or through the universe. But now that they see this thing, perchlorate, what the perchlorate's been doing is masking that signal. The way we look for organic material is actually all fouled up by the perchlorate. The perchlorate is an oxidant, so it burns up before we can see this organic material signal, and it's been hiding it. And so that's a pretty cool story. But then when you look on Earth, you see perchlorate in this place in Chile called the Atacama Desert, which is one of the most arid regions on Earth, if not the most arid. And that place is a lot like Mars. And so then you have perchlorate in the soil there, and if you repeat the Viking experiments, you get the same results. It looks like there isn't any organic material there either, but we know there is. And then if you want to like take a step back and get all wacky, in the Atacama Desert, you have little microbes that actually eat perchlorate. This is what they live on. This is their food. So we can start to space out a bit and dream of little microbes living on Mars.
Well, do we have any theories? Forget about the microbes, how the perchlorate came to be on Mars. Is this a natural consequence of certain kind of ice?
Yeah, I think it's a natural – it's a some sort of process of carbon dioxide breaking down. I'm not a chemist, and I will botch the chemistry and then get lots of people emailing me about what a poor chemist I am. But the way that I understand it, it forms through natural processes. And I don't have the technical answers.
But the first thing that people discovered was that there was all this water. There's a thing called Snow Queen.
So Snow Queen was this kind of amazing discovery. A few days into the mission, one of the scientists, Nilton Reno, he was curious about what was happening underneath the lander. And so they took some photos and they saw that the thrusters that they had used to land had disturbed the area underneath the lander. And so they started taking these photos of what was there, and they saw this big shiny material that looked like a giant blob of ice. And it turns out that there is a lot of ice there, that the results from the instruments confirm that, and it's very exciting. But while they were looking under the lander, they saw these kind of weird blobs on the lander struts. And these were most likely liquid water, which was this kind of crazy breakthrough that's still a little bit controversial about whether it's possible for there to be liquid water on Mars.
Well, if there's ice, why wouldn't there be liquid water? Doesn't ice melt into liquid water?
Ordinarily, yes, but on Mars, the pressure is so low that it would instantly sublimate. So it would just disappear into the atmosphere. Conventional wisdom would dictate that you could not have liquid water on Mars.
And what was the reaction when Milton Reno announced that there was liquid water on the rover? What was the reaction in the room when he made that claim? Did everybody say, wow, or were people dubious?
Much to my surprise, there was a kind of a free-for-all in when he challenged that orthodoxy. I think that people were a bit shocked that he would make such a wild claim, what seemed like a wild claim. And even today, I think there's a big dispute about whether his evidence holds up. And I think over time, more and more people are starting to accept his evidence. But even so, it's an amazing battle of discovery.
Well, part of the problem isn't it that we may not agree on evidence of life on Mars?
So
what that means?
Nilton, looking at liquid water, I guess there's a far step from that to life. But even so, I mean, it would be hard to say what is life. It's hard for us to define life. I mean, even if you want to say like just thought exercise in your head, like what's alive? If something's moving and it converts energy, then okay, that's a good definition. But then you get cars, and those aren't alive. We all know that cars aren't alive. But then you say, well, it has to reproduce or something. But then maybe a mule or donkey or, you know, so it's really confusing. And then the definition ends up being complex, and people argue over it, and it makes for good stories.
Well, we have thought about life on Mars for a long time. Orson Welles even panicked the country when he did a radio show about us being attacked by Martians.
He did indeed. And I think that a lot of our fears, you should rest assured that we won't be attacked anytime soon
by
any of the Martian microbes that might be eating perchlorate as their staple.
Now, were there some other important findings from the mission?
I think that the confirming that there was all this ice at the North Pole of Mars was a big deal. I mean, now that we have ice and we know that pretty confidently that liquid water once flowed on Mars, then we can start to take this next step for really confirming that there is life on Mars, that there was life on Mars.
And what happens if we find out that there is some kind of, I would assume, microbial life on Mars? Then what?
I guess the skies open up and we all have some grand epiphany about life. I don't know. I'm eager to find out.
Well, I guess this all fits in with the whole idea of whether there can be life on other planets.
Sure.
If there's life on Mars, even if it's microbial life.
But wouldn't it be fascinating to know what that looked like? Does it look like us? Does it look like little cells? Are the basic bits in those cells the same bits that we have in our cells?
You mean amino acids and all of that?
Right. I mean, is it based on, you know, NASA this year, they had this finding about arsenic-based life. And so wouldn't it be cool if there was just some weird looking thing that we have to kind of incorporate into our understanding of the universe.
Well, could the lander analyze what it was seeing there? Could it find DNA and amino acids?
No, unfortunately not. The lander, this is only our sixth trip to Mars, and this was a kind of a economy-sized mission. And we were still doing basic research, looking for the chemical makeup of the soil, the basic ingredients that are there, and then we have to extrapolate back on what we see, and then hopefully our next forays onto Mars will go with more and more sophisticated equipment, and then we'll start to answer more and more of these questions.
How much can we learn just from the images that are sent back?
I think we learn a ton from them. For instance, this liquid water discovery was the result of viewing images over time of watching the lander struts and how these nodules changed over time on the legs of the lander. And that was just basically from visual evidence. And it was then confirmed by more of the chemical evidence.
My guest is Andrew Kessler. His book, Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spaceman, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission. When we think back to the 60s and JFK challenging his generation to reach the moon by the end of that decade. We did, and visited the moon a couple of times. Everybody thought we would just keep on going. Did the people you were talking with discuss what they thought happened and why that enthusiasm has kind of died? Is it simply a matter of economics?
I think that somewhere along the way, we lost the audience for space. I suspect that it's because people felt like space started becoming routine and the missions became about these science goals that were a little abstract.
Mean mice and floating in cages, right, in outer space.
There were science goals for the moon landing, but I challenge anyone to tell me what they were. But we were excited, right? We were doing something exciting. We were exploring. And that was a great story. We had these awesome explorers and they were doing something new and they were passionate about it. And somewhere along the way, I think NASA maybe started taking a defensive posture and felt like they needed to be very results-based, and that became science goals. And so that's harder for people to connect with emotionally.
And now we can just go to some internet site and see all sorts of fascinating images from space, from the Hubble. There are cable channels that seem to be broadcasting 24 hours of images of stuff in space. Perhaps we've replaced real exploration with what we're just getting on the TV and through the internet.
To some degree, I think that's true. But I feel like even so, with all these amazing tools, the support has been waning. And I think it's up to people. We're missing those people to tell us that story, these heroes of exploration that will guide us on this path.
And that was your mission here, right? To publicize what's going on.
That's correct. And I think I found some.
In talking to people, do you think that you're going to turn people around? Do you think that this Congress Paul Ryan is now going to suggest that we change Medicare, but that we bring in a whole bunch of money to support exploration of Mars?
I have it on high authority that he's actually going to shift a lot of the Pentagon's budget into science and space exploration.
You mean people in Congress are talking that way?
No, I doubt it. But I wish they would be, because if we had this kind of – we're thrilled by science and these stories about exploration. I'm an equal opportunity science lover. I think that any shift towards people exploring, it doesn't matter what you want to explore, but explore something, that's good and that's important and that makes us good people.
Well, we're at this point, we are about to have our last space shuttle flight. So we're moving in the other direction, aren't we?
Yeah, it's kind of a sad thing, I guess, that we won't be launching any people into space for a little while. There needs to be some change, right? The people, there's not the political will and capital to keep up an effort that is thought of as a waste, right? So we need to reframe the debate, change the story, and get people excited so that they want to do this. We can't force people to think that space is interesting. They have to think that space is interesting.
Now, you're being on the show is the traditional way to promote a book. You're doing the book tour. But can you tell us about some of the other things that you're doing to promote it, like the videos?
Right.
The Mono Bookist bookstore?
I'll talk about the bookstore and the videos that we've made. We opened a little store in the West Village, Ed's Martian Book, and it's a Mono Bookist store.
What does that mean, Mono Bookist?
And that means that it only sells one book at a time. We were kind of inspired by the changing landscape of publishing and thought that the time was right to mess with the book selling model on a small scale.
So you're selling one book, and I imagine it's this book.
Yeah, so I was very fortunate to have Martian Summer chosen as the first book that Ed's Martian Book sells. And you can go and visit the store on Hudson Street, and you'll be treated to a display of books and dioramas and super fun, hot Mars talk.
And I'm guessing that it's important to get kids excited about this because they're the ones who are actually going to force the issue somewhere down the line. But what are some of the next phases for studying Mars? What's the Mars Science Laboratory that'll be launched at the end of the year?
So that's an exciting mission. It's much larger than Phoenix. This mission is about a mini Cooper-sized rover that's going to land on Mars with the capability to look for organic material in a different way that we talked about before, how perchlorate was hiding the signal of organic material potentially. And this guy can detect organic material in a new way that doesn't involve heating it. So there's could be lots of exciting results. It's got this amazing way of landing off of a sky crane that's going to kind of hover down and then lower this big rover. It's pretty impressive. If you get a chance to check out JPL's website, they have these amazing movies of the landing.
So they have to do that because a parachute wouldn't work or a balloon wouldn't work with something that heavy?
I think that's the problem. It's too heavy to land in a conventional way. So they're working on this new method of landing larger objects with this sky crane.
And I know these kinds of predictions are almost impossible to make, but do you think that humans will be going to Mars any time in the near future?
I would love to see it. It doesn't seem like it. I think we have to get people excited, back on the bandwagon first, and then do more missions, discover more interesting things, and I think that would eventually lead to us taking a larger leap, which is sending men to Mars.
Well, what was it about your experience that got you so hooked? Was it the people or the mission, the science, the discoveries?
It's the people. When you go hear Peter Smith talk about Mars, it's really hard not to fall in love with that story. He's just an amazing guy who's really passionate about what he does and what he thinks the importance of exploring is.
And are you invited back for the next one?
I'm checking my mail daily. I haven't received the invitation yet.
The book is Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spaceman, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission. It is published by Pegasus. And as we said, Andrew has created and is running a pop-up bookstore called Ed's Martian Books. It's at 547 Hudson Street. That's at Perry Street. And it is open through May 10th. You might want to go and check it out. And I envy you. I would have loved to have
You'll come next time.
Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.